You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock, the world's weekly journey into the big future. Browse our previous programs free at our website, ecoshock.org, and you can also find contact information for me there.
We know the big problems threatening humanity and the natural world. We even have some affordable solutions. So why do we keep driving on so hard it seems like towards the cliff of extinction? Maybe it's all in the mind. In this program, we'll add to my short list of interviews on eco-psychology. Stephen Kotler is one of those endangered species called a real journalist. He's been published in the New York Times Magazine, Wired, and much more. His best-selling 2012 book, co-authored with Peter Diamandis, is Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. From New Mexico, Stephen Kotler, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, I have to admit, I think the future is much worse than you think, but maybe that's my damaged mindset. So let's talk about the really fine article you published in Orion Magazine, Eco-Psychology in 10 Easy Lessons. First of all, Stephen, why did you go bushwhacking in southern Chile, in Patagonia, in fact?
Well, one of the foundational principles in eco-psychology is that there's a very kind of deep and fundamental connection between the human mind and the natural world. And a lot of people have pointed out that there are psychological consequences that we're not aware of for, you know, the destruction that we're imparting on the natural world. And to get really kind of up close and personal with this, you know, in the midst of so much global warming, fear and noise, not, I don't mean hype at all, but I mean, like, we're hearing it everywhere in every direction. If you care about this earth, it's coming everywhere. You know, if you're going to look at eco-destruction, I wanted to see the melting of the glaciers up close, and I wanted to sort of apply the principles of eco-psychology and kind of get up close to this absolute killing of the natural world and see what it did to my brain.
Well, you know, I had to laugh along with you, Steve, once you were lost in the cold thinking, hey, eco-psychology is just a diversion for people who are warm at home. Is the conversation about the role of our minds just a pastime for first world folks with time on our hands?
That trip, my interest in eco-psychology, I wrote a book called A Small Furry Prayer about the relationship between human and animals. And my wife and I co-run an animal sanctuary in northern New Mexico. And A Small Furry Prayer is sort of about our experiences. And the book was very successful. It was a bestseller. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. And I went on this giant book tour and 50 cities. And the only people who came to my readings were animal lovers. Nobody, didn't matter how successful the book was, none of that mattered. It was just hardcore animal geeks were the only people showing up. And I started to notice this vast disconnect. It was like I lived in a world where there was nature and there was animals, and I saw these things on a daily basis. But a lot of the people, especially on the other side of my work where I deal with kind of technology and I'm in Silicon Valley and those things, they don't see the natural world. Even if I'm talking about dogs or the work we do here, they're not hearing me, and it's not coming in. So one of the things that I was looking at is, what is the difference? Why are some people able to kind of perceive nature and to really see what's going on, and other people are completely oblivious? That's a neurological, psychological issue with, you know, huge political and social and ecological ramifications. So that was sort of what set me off there in the first place.
And I was really interested in how you tied in James Lovelock's Gaia theory and then how that was brought into eco-psychology by the late Paul Shepard. Can you talk to us about that, Stephen?
So James Lovelock, with Gaia, right, figured out that the Earth is potentially a giant living cybernetic feedback system, right, a sort of a living organism. And what Paul Shepard, who's just was a brilliant, brilliant mind, brilliant ecologist, kind of realized that if this was true, right, if the Earth actually is a giant cybernetic feedback organism, and you can argue Gaia in all different directions, but there are certainly, you know, there's certainly a lot of interesting proof in the direction that it's a legit theory at this point. And Shepard said, hey, if this is legit, then if we're one giant living organism, then there are direct connections between the natural world and the human mind. And the great, and this isn't his, James Serpel also kind of poked at this idea. A lot of people have poked at it, but what Paul Shepard kind of pointed out is that, for example, we didn't grow up thinking of animals as other. We actually grew up thinking in animals. They were our first metaphor. They're still the metaphor we reach for. He's as hungry as a wolf. The terminology goes on and on. But he literally, his argument is, we learn to think in animals. We learn to think in nature. It was our first kind of comparisons, our first grounds for comparisons. It's how we learn to navigate the natural world, and these sort of deep structures, to use Claude Lévi-Strauss's word, are sort of embedded in our brain. So his argument is that we are experiencing kind of the death of the natural world at a really deep fundamental level that goes in so far and so primal and so kind of baked into our evolution that we don't notice the massive damage it's doing.
Well, this idea that damage to nature is also damaging our own mental health is gaining more ground. There was a U.S. National Wildlife Federation report on it in 2012 with experts, and I just saw an article about it in a major Canadian newspaper, February 28th.
Yeah, absolutely. The eco-psychology, it's not a new field. It's been around for 30, 40 years at this point. I'm thinking Theodore Roszak coined the term, I think, in the 70s, maybe in the 80s. The ideas have been around, they've been percolating a while, and, you know, there is all kinds of very, very, very real science, both on the cause, like we understand some of the neurobiology of what we're talking about here, as well as the effect side. So for sure, I mean, eco-psychology is why they have found that a 20-minute walk in the woods outperforms all the ADHD medicines on the market. We have a deep psychological relationship to nature, and if you want to calm down the brain, walking in natural spaces is more effective than the best drugs we have. And there's study after study after study showing this.
That's true. I read about that. That's very true. Okay, now, you also mentioned Laura Seawall and her essay, The Skill of Ecological Perception. I'm not familiar with that one. How does that tie into what you were working on?
Essentially, what you're talking about when you're talking about eco-psychology is awareness. And I'm going to talk about this from a neurobiological angle. So every second of every day, your senses take in a massive, massive, massive amount of information. It's been calculated somewhere between, and this is a ridiculous range, 11 million bits a second and 400 billion bits a second. Whatever it is way, way too much for the conscious mind to process. The extreme outer limit of what we can process consciously, what our working memory can hold on to at once, is essentially 2,000 bits. And most of us really can only hold on to about 120 bits at once. And to put that in context, you're listening to me talk, that is taking up 60 bits of RAM in your brain. So there's only about two people talking, and that's it. So you've got this massive amount of information coming in and a very, very reduced consciousness, very few bits of information. Now, most of your consciousness, because of how the brain is wired up and how information filters through the brain, is filled with stuff that we could possibly be afraid of for obvious evolutionary reasons. We want to survive, so we pay a lot of attention to those things that scare us. It's some significant portion of our consciousness. I've heard numbers all over the place. 70% of the stuff that gets in is one thing that I hear fairly often. It's basically stuff that we could be afraid of. If you're talking about 2,000 bits coming in a second and 60, 70% is taken up by stuff that could kill us or we're worried that could kill us, very little other information is coming through. If you don't care about the natural world, if that's not interesting to you, if you're not noticing, it will be invisible to you. And this is something, you know, we're talking about this very, very theoretically, but I spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley, a lot of time around a lot of technologists who are taking on grand global challenges, poverty, hunger, water, really significant issues, and yet they live in a world that's very technological, they sit in front of screens all day long, they very rarely get into the natural world, and they don't even see nature. So the very people, I believe, and this is sort of what we write about in Abundance a little bit, who are best suited to address some of the challenges that we're facing, they don't even see the fact that there are challenges out there because they don't see nature, because they haven't tuned their brain to appreciate it at all, so it can't come in. What Laura Seawall has done, to return back to your original question, is she has sort of broken our what I'm terming appreciation, what I literally mean is the ability to see the natural world. She's come up with a 5-step process with which somebody can kind of learn to see the natural world. It was a process I was playing with when I was down in Patagonia. And, you know, the funny thing about the process, as I pointed out in the article, I went down to Patagonia, and it was already an arduous trip to kind of the end of the earth, but, you know, the storm of the century blew in. We had 100-mile-an-hour winds. As you read in the article, I got blown off the side of like a 30-foot waterfall and landed in shrubbery because the wind was so fierce. And, you know, it's kind of funny when you're trying to, like, deploy these five steps towards ecological perception, you know, so you can see the natural world at a very point that, like, the natural world is doing nothing but kicking your butt.
Well, you know, if human intelligence was developed over a very long time as hunter-gatherers, is it really any wonder we've become so crazy living in these concrete boxes looking at screens where nature's more or less banned, just as you said?
Yeah, it's certainly no way around it. Everything we know about evolution teaches us that these things are going to be encoded pretty, pretty deep, and to deny ourselves access to it is just, it's significant. And, you know, there's massive mental health concerns. We know being out in the natural world is something that lifts depression. Same reasons, right? Like, we're wired this way. We need that contact. I'll give you a crazy, totally separate thing that nobody actually in the world knows exists. But I run a dog sanctuary, and part of our healing methodology is to create an environment, because we work with very, very sick animals, is to create an environment using evolutionary psychology that's very, very similar to an environment that dogs evolved in. So dogs evolved in small groups of humans, big groups of dogs, and they all den together, right? Like, we slept with dogs. That was one of the reasons we cohabitated with them. The phrase three-dog night is literally a night so cold that you need three dogs in the bed to survive, right? It's even in our coded into our language. So here's something that interesting. This is eco-psychology in action. Dogs have better senses of hearing and better senses of smell than humans. So when you cohabitate with dogs, and this is what we evolved to do, so everybody's hardwired to do what I'm about to explain. What happens is, after a little while of kind of sharing your bed with a bunch of dogs, this big pack, is you start outsourcing safety and security. So you have a hyper-vigilant response in your brain every second. It's kind of screening for danger, right? But dogs smell better. They hear better. They're better danger detectors. So the process naturally, just by cohabitating with dogs, gets outsourced. So when I go, I do a lot of public speaking, I do a lot of traveling, I'm on the road. The second day I'm in a motel, my body will start to realize I'm not surrounded by dogs, and my vigilance centers will turn back on. And for that entire, the second night I'm in a hotel, I won't sleep because every sound wakes me up because I'm not hardwired to actually deal with it. I co-evolved with dogs. I'm hardwired to outsource that to them and let them deal with it. And when that goes away, raises my stress response. I lose sleep.
Do you find yourself longing for the apocalypse? I did. I was looking for a reason to live. Hi. Are you feeling tired, irritable, stressed out? Well, you might consider nature.
From the people that brought you Getting Outside comes prescription-strength Nature, a non-harmful medication shown to relieve the crippling symptoms of modern life.
Nature's recommended for humans of all ages, and it's great for pets, too.
Nature can reduce cynicism, meaninglessness, anal retentiveness, and murderous rage. In clinical studies, Nature is proven to decrease work-induced catatonia.
Caution. Nature may cause you to slow down, quit your job, or seriously consider what the f*** you're doing with your life.
If you are overly cynical, jaded, or emotionally numb, you may need to increase your dose.
Do you find yourself longing for the apocalypse? I did. I was looking for a reason to live. Hi. Are you feeling tired, irritable, stressed out? Well, you might consider nature.
From the people that brought you Getting Outside comes prescription-strength Nature, a non-harmful medication shown to relieve the crippling symptoms of modern life.
Nature's recommended for humans of all ages, and it's great for pets, too.
Nature can reduce cynicism, meaninglessness, anal retentiveness, and murderous rage. In clinical studies, nature is proven to decrease work-induced catatonia.
Caution. Nature may cause you to slow down, quit your job, or seriously consider what the f*** you're doing with your life.
If you are overly cynical, jaded, or emotionally numb, you may need to increase your dose of nature. Do you have trouble being even mildly uncomfortable? Nature may not be right for you. Side effects may include spontaneous euphoria, taking yourself less seriously, and being in a good mood for no apparent reason.
So ask your doctor if nature is right for you.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, talking with the best-selling author and journalist Stephen Kotler about the prizes and the perils of eco-psychology and many other things. If you'll give me a second, Steve, I'd like to read a short quote from your article, Eco-Psychology in 10 Easy Lessons. After looking at the meltdown of the glacier, you were saying once this meltdown is complete, it will not reverse. The freshly melted water will never become ice again, at least not in any time frame that is fathomable in human terms. What does it feel like to witness these end times, awful, like murder, like I'm the one who is melting? So I'm wondering if we can really, Stephen, stand the pain of recognizing ourselves in this eco-psychological mirror.
It's an interesting question. I think about this a lot because I think anybody with any kind of environmental awareness these days, you sort of have to function at all in this world, numb a huge portion of yourself, ignore a huge portion of kind of what's going on around you at all times, which, you know, I'm no expert, but I can't think it's healthy.
Yeah. You know, I've had guests who've compared our behavior in these times to the mass murders of the Holocaust in World War II. Do you think that's going too far?
You know, I think that's a very hot, touchy subject, but we've got species die-off rates that are 1,000 times greater than normal. It's the sixth great extinction. You're comparing that to a Holocaust, right? An attempt to murder a people. But if you're, you know, I'm going to get killed for this, but if you're working the numbers, I mean, we're talking about whole species, many species, going extinct forever every year. So, you know, I know people care more about people than they do plants and animals, and those kinds of comparisons make them very, very upset. But I always look at this question kind of neurobiologically. For a really long time, nobody kind of wanted, you know, dogs were research animals. And dogs are essentially, from an intelligence perspective, from an emotional perspective, they have the same six core emotions we do, the same social emotions we do. They're essentially four-year-old children in their IQ and vocabulary. And, you know, we do things to dogs that we would never do to four-year-old children. So people don't like it when you make those comparisons between, say, you know, the sixth great extinction and the Holocaust. But I don't think you're that far off.
Well, given all we've talked about, what gives you the optimism about the future found in your best-selling book, Abundance?
Well, so you have to understand that what is at the core of abundance is this idea that right now, for the first time in history, because of four emerging forces, we have the possibility to significantly raise global standards of living and address many of our grand challenges. And the difficulty here is it's a race against time, right? We're either going to drive ourselves into a world of abundance or we're going to wipe ourselves off the face of the earth. And we're not saying this is techno-utopianism. Our argument is not that this stuff happens automatically. It's that it is actually possible. We know how to... even the sixth great extinction, like, this is no mystery. We've known since the 60s, essentially, how to stop the sixth great extinction. You take a bunch of land away from people and you give it back to the plants and animals. You link up our national parks with migration corridors and you stay out of the way. You give animals more space and more room to roam. We've known that since, you know, Michael Soule did his island biogeography work back in the 60s and 70s. It's not a mystery, right? We now have the technology that liberates that land. For example, cattle occupy one quarter of all the land on the earth. We have in vitro meat. We can grow steak from stem cells. You know, painless beef grown from stem cells in bioreactors frees up a quarter of the land on the planet. We can repurpose that land for animals. It's not hard, and people are doing it. In fact, the U.S. military has been doing this, you know, for 80 years. They've been setting up eco barriers and migration corridors, and, you know, they found it the most successful thing they could do to kind of fight off lawsuits from environmentalists, and it works. It brings species back. We've seen it. We've got the proof. We know how to solve this, and we have the technology, and that's just one example. I could talk about vertical farms. I could go on and on about this stuff, but we have the technology to solve these problems. Are we going to do it is an open question. And but what we are saying in abundance is, hey, wait a minute, this is actually now possible today. And we're also saying that a lot of the bad news you believe in is actually wrong. You have wrong information. And I'll just give you a couple of examples since we got in this direction. One of the things that's really, really tricky is that, take poverty, for example. It's something of a moving target. If you go back 100 years ago, the richest people on the planet did not have air conditioning, a cell phone, a telephone, a television, air conditioning, a car, flushing toilets, running water for that matter. Today, people living below the poverty line, 70% of people below the poverty line have access to all those things. So we keep moving the number, but if you go by, you know, current studies at current rates of decline, by current definitions of poverty, you know, and this is studies run in The Economist by top thinkers, we're going to end poverty by our current definition in 30 years. Or if you go, you know, you want to go back in time, poverty has been reduced more in the past 50 years than any point in the previous 500. According to Steven Pinker, we are living at the most peaceful time in the history of the human race. Any groceries are 13 times cheaper today than they were in the 1800s. The list goes kind of on and on about what's kind of going on. So there's actually a ton of really great news that we don't tend to look at. And by the way, the reason we don't look at it is because our brain is dominated by looking for danger. So we notice the negative much more than the positive. And that's like, you know, established psychological and neurobiological fact. Basically, for every kind of one positive thing that gets into your brain, you'll notice 10 negative things.
That's so cool what you just said. You know, I've had this argument too with Brian Welch. He's the CEO of the company that publishes Mother Earth News, and he wrote a book, Beautiful and Abundant, Building the World We Want. And he got me thinking, is it possible that we have so much trouble partly because we lack a vision of who we want to be?
Oh, I think you hit it on the nail. I mean, I really, like, we go where we look. And what I mean that is, like, we are literally hardwired biologically to go where we look. And this is a weird example. Do you surf by any chance?
I did when I was younger.
Okay. Have you ever ridden a tube?
I never really got that good.
Okay. One of the things that happens when you're tube riding is when you pull into the wave, you make your bottom turn, and all you do is you look through the tube, because everything is happening at so high speed. So how do you surf a tube? You literally look through the tube, and your body goes where you look. Everything else sort of happens automatically. That's not just a surfing athletic phenomenon. That is how we are wired to work. I'll give you another crazy example, and this comes out of, I run the Flow Genome Project. We study ultimate human performance. So this is stuff that comes out of the other side of the work I do and studies of ultimate human performance. But in ultimate human performance, there's something called the Bannister effect, and it's really peculiar. So Roger Bannister, as you probably know, is the first guy to run the 4-minute mile. And before he did it, everybody thought it was impossible. There were New York Times op-eds written by doctors saying, look, the first person who runs a 4-minute mile is going to die at the finish line. Forget a parade. You're going to need a hearse. And it took forever to do it. I mean, if you look at mile times, they went down by like a half a second, a fraction of a second, a decade, for like 60 years. And then Bannister does it, and the next month, somebody beats his time. And a couple months after that, somebody else beats his time, and within 10 years, a teenager has beat his time. So what the hell? Right, the physical challenge running a 4-minute mile did not change. It's still a sub-4 mile. It's really physically difficult. All that changed is the mental frame we build around the challenge. This is called the Bannister effect, and what it means is there's a very, very tight correlation between psychology and performance. You have to believe something is possible before it's possible. And there are, for all the reasons we've been talking about, kind of how the brain filters information, for all the reasons that you might imagine, this is very, very true. So one of the things, you know, I often have said is if we want to solve a lot of problems, we could just start by getting the technologists and the environmentalists and the ecologists in the same room together so they see each other and hear each other and have to talk to each other. I really do believe, you know, the solutions are within our reach. But I'll give you an interesting example. In abundance, for example, one of the things that we talk about is if you want to solve the biodiversity crisis, coupling in vitro meat to vertical farms, two technologies that massively liberate land and repurposing this land for animals and plants. It's the center of the book. We talk about it in the book. And yet the book came out, it was a massive bestseller, and in the hundreds of interviews and talks and speeches and whatever I've done about the book, nobody's ever asked me about that because nobody sees nature. They see all the other stuff we wrote about feeding people and getting people water and providing freedom and health care and education, all the people-centered stuff. But the animal stuff is still a giant mystery to people. So I think the solutions are there, and it's really important to know that they're there because we're hardwired to go where we look.
Well, just as we wrap up, what is the Flow Genome Project?
We are the largest kind of open source research project in ultimate human performance. We want to decode the science of ultimate human performance, and it's called the Flow Genome Project because flow is a technical term, scientific term, for a state of optimal performance. It's a state where we feel our best and we perform our best. And more specifically, it refers to those moments, I'm sure you've experienced them yourself, of rapt attention, total absorption. You get so focused on what you're doing, everything else just vanishes. So action, awareness start to merge, time dilates, which is a fancy way of saying you don't notice that it's passing. 5 hours will go by in like 5 minutes. Your sense of self sort of disappears, self-conscious, and that voice in your head, that incessant chatter, goes quiet. And performance, all aspects, go through the roof. And flow science sort of dates back about 150 years, but over the past 20 years, it's been a revolution in neurobiology. We've been able to look under the hood for the very first time, see where the state is coming from, see how it shows up, how we can get more of it. And so the Flow Genome Project is an organization of people who are dedicated to kind of decoding the science of flow, and we're training people up in it. So we're a research and a training organization, and on the training side, we work with everybody from kind of top athletes to the U.S. Special Forces to Fortune 500 companies, and we train people up in how to maximize flow and productivity and motivation and those sorts of things.
Is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to pass on to our listeners or a new project you want to tell us about?
The only thing I want to pass along is if this stuff is interesting to you, you can find me online at stephencotler.com or at theflowgenomeproject.com or on Twitter at Stephen_Kotler, which is K-O-T-L-E-R.
Well, we based this interview on Ecopsychology and 10 Easy Lessons in Orion Magazine, and I'll put a link to that on my blog at ecoshock.info. You may also be interested in Stephen Kotler's book Tomorrowland, Our Journey from Science Fiction to Science Fact. That sounds good to me. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, my pleasure. Thank you.
Radio EcoShock reaches out to you every week from over 90 nonprofit radio stations in 4 countries and countless net stations. If you agree this program content is important, you can help. Please go ahead and forward the show widely. Tweet about it. Get it on Facebook. Play it for your friends. Thank you for helping me get the word out by extending the voice of our expert guests.